From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief. State of Belief can be heard across the country weekends on Air America Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by Interfaith Alliance and its members. For more information on Interfaith Alliance and its work promoting faith and freedom throughout America, visit interfaithalliance.org. And while you're there, please consider supporting State of Belief and this free podcast service by making a tax-deductible donation to Interfaith Alliance Foundation. We need your help to keep State of Belief on the air. Thank you for listening.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everybody, to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of Interfaith Alliance, broadcasting from the Air America studios in New York City. On today's show, we mark another anniversary of September 11th, and later in the program, we're going to hear from the author of a new book on how Muslim Americans fared in the wake of that national tragedy. And I tell you, you may be surprised by what you hear. Plus, a new interfaith effort brings together Muslims and Christians, but they're not breaking bread together. In fact, quite the opposite. They are fasting together. We'll hear more about that shortly. But first, President Barack Obama addressed the country earlier this week with a much-awaited speech on health care. Here with me now to share his impressions is Rabbi Irwin Kula. Rabbi Kula is president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He's the author of Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. He is the 2008 award winner of the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award, and he is my friend. Rabbi Kula, welcome back to State of Belief.
Great to be here. Great to be here.
I want to talk about the president's speech in just a moment. But first, as someone who's written about messiness, you must have some thoughts on this mess that's going on in America lately. This healthcare debate has released a vitriol in certain parts of the American public that I'm not quite sure is even about healthcare. What are your thoughts on the climate in America leading up to the president's speech?
Look, I'm actually more of an optimist, I think, than most people. I think this is a, as the president said, this is a really serious issue. We have been trying to reform healthcare for 40, 50 years. And so there's a lot of heated feelings about it. And there are at least two very serious reasons for this. One is the political and economic structures are going to be rearranged because we're going to be affecting one-sixth of the total, you know, kind of power in this country. Mm-hmm. So I understand people defend their interests. And part of the greatness of America is that we go through these processes. They are difficult. People do get out of hand. It's a minority of people that really are getting out of hand, you know. And so it's not like we're having riots in the streets. We're not having a civil war. We have some town hall meetings in which some people are really out of hand. But this is not out of control. So one reason is real political and economic structures are going to be destabilized here for people. And I think what the president did is he got up and he said, look, no more lying. Not allowed to lie. Okay, we can have real disagreements, but you're not allowed to lie and create fear. And he said very clearly, this is a challenge to the character of the country. And character challenges, whether it's personal or countrywide, are very hard. I know when my character gets challenged, right, by my wife. I married 27 years last week, 2 weeks ago. And when my wife says, hey, you're not being such a nice guy, you know, and she challenges my character, it doesn't always bring out the best in me initially. So these These are very serious issues, and therefore we have all this messiness.
I forget how badly I need to talk with you every once in a while and hear that optimism. But let me just do one follow-up on that, and then we'll get to the speech. Is there a level of incivility that we've seen in the town halls and that was even present in the form of one Republican congressman yelling out to the president, "You lie"? Were people able to hear the president's speech for what it was?
I think that's a great question. I think that most of Congress has already decided. And my sense is that Republicans, I don't believe there's bad people, good people. These are interests, real serious interests.
And I think special interests.
Special
right?
interests. Yes. And I think Republicans have made a decision in general, one, that these interests are not to be undermined right now. And they also want to see the president defeated because they have a different view of how the society should run. I don't believe Republicans don't want people to have health care. McCain wants people to have health care. The worst Republicans want, the worst conservatives, they want people to have health care, but they really do have a different worldview. The worldview is that markets will, in the end, correct themselves such that people will get health care. And they don't believe in government getting involved in any significant way in this area. Now, this has been a long debate, and it's exactly what the president said the other night. It's exactly what he said. He said there has been, long-term in this country, a debate about the role of government. And the great moments in this country is when government did step in and engage in a major corrective. We forget to get the civil rights legislation signed in this country took all the way from the beginnings of the country through a civil war, which was a lot messier than some crazy congressman yelling, "You're a liar," who then is forced to apologize nationally within the hour. Okay.
So did the president make the case for health care reform that he needed to make?
I think his goal, it seemed to me, was to get Democrats, because I don't think he feels Republicans. I think they've given up on that. I think that he made a case to Democrats to say, listen, in the end, the character of this country will depend on this. And we know for the last 50 years we've been trying to do this. And it's we who have always made the big moves. We made the move in civil rights. And by the way, it cost Democrats for 25 years. South didn't vote Democratic. Mm-hmm. So there was a tremendous cost they paid for doing the civil rights. It was we who did Medicare. It was we who did Social Security. In the end, government has a role to play in lifting up those who are most vulnerable. Right. And we can do it responsibly.
Erwin, you are a respected rabbi. You are a religious leader in this country. What is the proper role for the faith community to play in this debate on health care?
I think this is a critical question. The one thing we can't do is everyone can't bring their scripture and their God to legitimate their public policy position. God is on all sides on this, or God's on no sides. And if we make God small, it turns out we have to have big guns. If we make God big, then we can have the conversation on the ground that we need to have. So no using scripture, no using God to legitimate individual public policy pieces. The role of religion and spirituality is to remind people that God is so big, that the reality is so infinite, that all of us are connected inside that, and there's a partial truth in every one of our voices. And then it's up to politicians and to people who are policy wonks and for people who want to delve into the particular policies to argue on the merits of that policy without bringing God into the picture.
Erwin, I have not heard it said any better. Rabbi Erwin Cooler is president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He's the author of Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. It's always good for you to be on State of Belief, and this was one of the best.
Thank you. I love being on the show. You know that. And I love you. You're one of my heroes, so just know that.
Take care, man.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Welton Getty. This is State of Belief. And here on the program, we have a regular segment. You all know this. We call it our Intersection Awards. Now, that's when we look at news at the intersection of religion, politics, and culture. And we typically assign either red lights to those who use religion in a negative way or green lights to recognize newsmakers using religion in a positive way. And sometimes we use yellow lights for caution in this busy intersection. Well, I'm a longtime sports fan, and a story about religion in baseball recently caught my eye. ESPN and Major League Baseball have agreed to move the starting time of the heavily awaited Yankees-Red Sox game because the two baseball rivals were set to face off at 8 p.m. on September 27th. But September 27 is also Yom Kippur, the most sacred day on the Jewish calendar, a solemn day for fasting and atonement, which begins at sundown. A night game would, of course, mean that observant Jews who also happen to like the Sox and the Yankees couldn't tune in or attend and root for their team. So now the game will air at 1 p.m. So this week, we give a green light to Major League Baseball and ESPN for accommodating all sports fans, even those who practice Judaism instead of baseball as their religion.
Play ball!
Now, we've got to take a short break after that, but there's more to come. You have an interest in all of it, so don't go anywhere. We're coming right back. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. And there's been something on my mind recently that I'd like to share with you a little bit about in a segment that we call Preaching to the Choir. Lately, the level of incivility in this nation is bothering me terribly. But more importantly, it's destroying the fabric of our democracy. And it better stop before we find ourselves in a gridlock wedged between counter forces of hatred. Politicians who care more about hardline partisan ideology than the welfare of the republic must bear part of the blame. But so too must religious leaders who have drunk so much partisan political Kool-Aid that they no longer can tell the difference between religion and politics, or, more tragically, between their wills and the truth that is common to all scriptures and oral traditions that recognize the truth of God. This past week, my spirits were lifted a bit, and a glimpse of hope occurred in response to some words from an unexpected but much welcomed source. Mark DeMoss, who bills himself as a Christian public relations executive, spoke out against the swelling tidal wave of incivility among us, his eyes having been opened to incivility and his conscience troubled by religious bigotry during his work on the presidential primary campaign of Mitt Romney. Though he represents such religious right notables as Franklin Graham and Chuck Colson, several months ago, Mr. DeMoss joined efforts with Democratic leader Lanny Davis to launch a civility project. DeMoss has specifically called for religious leaders to model the kind of civility that is becoming an endangered species in our society. Now, you would think that no one could counter that opinion with criticism or opposition, at least no one self-identified as a religious leader. Ah, contraire. Much of the U.S. public is aware that recently a man named Chris Broughton showed up in a crowd gathering for a speech by President Obama in Phoenix, Arizona. Broughton showed up with an AR-15 automatic rifle slung across his shoulder and holding a handgun. Oh, but there have always been people like this, you say. We just have to be very careful. Please hear the rest of the story. The night before the Obama speech, Broughton had listened to his pastor, Stephen L. Anderson, pastor of the Faithful Word Baptist Church in Tempe, Arizona, spew hatred with the authority and excitement of a traveling soul-winning evangelist. After raising the rhetorical question of whether or not he was supposed to pray for President Obama, Pastor Broughton launched into a poisonous tirade of name-calling in which the so-called minister labeled President Obama as, his words, the socialist devil murderer infanticide who wants to see babies killed. I'm not going to pray for his good, speaking of Obama. I'm going to pray he dies and goes to hell. Honestly, friends, I find myself sickened reporting this story and even hinting that it has anything to do with religion. Was the pastor pleading for God to become a murderer, I wondered to myself? Yes. Yes, he was. Later, the pastor said he hoped Obama would be struck with a brain tumor that would cause him to die like Ted Kennedy did. And for urgency, he said, today. My God. My God, what has religion come to? Well, it hasn't really come to that, no. Abuse of a good thing is still abuse, not the good thing it's seeking to ruin. The man with the guns on his body was inspired to act on the words of a man with hate in his heart. And that qualifies as no kind of religion that I know. Just the opposite, really. Look, civility is difficult under the best of circumstances, but in the face of bigotry that looks like insanity, civility takes on the appearance of impossibility. It's not, of course, but we have our work cut out for us. Mr. DeMoss and Mr. Davis, with their civility project, are doing our nation a favor, and all of us who care about this nation better affirm them and find a way to do our part for civility as well. Surely we know either we will recover the art of civil rhetoric, which is oil without which the machinery of democracy cannot run, or we will become a fragmented nation of paranoid people shouting at each other across ever-widening divides as if that will take care of all of our problems. Not only can a divided nation not stand, as Lincoln taught us, it can't take care of the public welfare. Why, it will not even be able to applaud a leader for efforts to encourage children to get an education that makes them better people and good citizens. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. We've got to pause now for another moment. Our break will be quick, but there is a lot more to come that you will want to hear. And when we come back, we'll take a look at how Ramadan is bringing together Muslims and non-Muslims this year. And we'll talk about this interfaith, fascinating partnership when we come back. Stick around. We'll see you in just a moment. This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. Muslims around the world continue to fast for Ramadan. The month-long observance will continue until the third weekend of September this year. And during this time, followers of Islam refrain from eating and drinking from sunup to sundown. But recently, I learned that Muslims are not the only ones observing the fast. I was rereading the Washington Post the other day when I came across an article by Eboo Patel, who is a fellow columnist for the paper's On Faith blog. Eboo's column is called The Faith Divide, and in the article to which I'm referring, Eboo writes about the practice of fasting partnerships. That's when a non-Muslim, In Eboo's case, a Christian joins a Muslim in the fast. Now, I thought this was a wonderful expression of interreligious solidarity, and I am delighted to be joined right now by Eboo Patel. Eboo is the founder and executive director of the Interfaith Youth Corps, a Chicago-based global interfaith youth movement. He's been on this show many times. Also with me, though, is Brian McLaren, a Christian writer and activist. Brian, Eboo, thanks to both of you for joining us on State of Belief.
Great to be here with you.
Thank you, Welton.
I'm curious now, Eboo, did you contact Brian or did he contact you? How did this partnership come about?
Well, Brian contacted me. I think it would have been too much if Muslims went around asking their Christian friends to fast with them for 30 days. I was inspired by Brian's contacting me. And it is the continuation of a friendship and the continuation of my being inspired by one of the great Christian voices and activists of our time.
Brian, I have to tell you, I don't know many colleagues in the Christian community, especially at leadership levels in Christianity, who call someone wanting to fast. how did this happen?
Well, it's a beautiful story, really. I could go back really to September 11, 2001, actually the following day, September 12th. Our church had a little prayer gathering, and while we were together, I just felt in my own soul that I needed to reach out and become friends with the Muslim leaders in my area. I realized there were four mosques or Muslim community centers near my church, and I didn't know anybody there. And I realized that while people are tearing each other apart, some of us need to go and try to bind up those wounds. So some friendships began for me. And what tipped me over the edge was earlier this year, I was speaking, and this lady came up to me, and her name is Nadine Parr, and Nadine lives in Grand Rapids, and she's a Christian lady, and she had become friends with the mother of one of her children's playmates, and this woman is Muslim. And the friendship that grew out of between these two women, they started a group called Peace Moms. It's actually, if people want to look it up, it's peacemoms.com. And Nadine told me that she had begun joining her friend Soraya in the Ramadan fast. And as soon as she said it to me, I thought, this year I should try to do that. This is a good thing.
But I'm curious as to what the shared experience has done to see for both of you in seeing similarities between the two traditions.
The way that I think about similarities and differences between religions is that we have shared values. That's what I'm most interested in. I'm most interested in the values that Christianity, Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, secular humanism share, and then how those traditions speak to those values in very specific and particular ways. So I would ask Brian, you know, tell me what it is in Christianity that speaks to mercy. What's the scripture? What are the heroes? What are the poetry? What's the art? What speaks to that idea? And let me tell you what it is in Islam that speaks to mercy. And then let's ask ourselves the question, what can we do concretely and tangibly in the world that realizes that collective aspiration of being of mercy?
Brian, talk about the similarity issue for you.
I totally agree with what Eboo said. There are so many values that we share. And in fact, when you focus on the values that we share, the fact that there's so much fear and hatred and all the rest and violence, it becomes absolutely inconceivable and almost pathetic. But what's also interesting is how those values get expressed in practices. So, for example, the practice of fasting, as I have learned about it in Islam, in the month of Ramadan, is about several values underneath. One of the values is the value of self-control, that I don't want to let my body and my life be controlled by physical impulses and desires. And, of course, we all see what happens when the desire for alcohol gets out of control, when the desire for sex gets out of control. And so, in a way, fasting becomes a kind of an exercise. It's like getting a workout at the gym or another value, I'm sorry, is the value of caring for the poor. And so the idea that for a month I am going to experience hunger and thirst that I wouldn't normally experience, and every time I do, I'm going to try to remind myself, I get to end this in 6 hours. But there are people who live with this for every day, and I want now to feel the value of compassion. If we started looking at our faith communities as these core values that Eboo spoke about, expressed in practices, I just think it helps us approach one another in a lot more productive way.
Eboo, you have obviously fasted during Ramadan before. I'm curious as to how having a partner this year changes the experience for you, if at all.
Well, I think of this kind of musically. I think of this as people playing different instruments, sounding good together. There are things happening in the world. You know, this is the kind of the butterfly in Australia causes a windstorm in America kind of thing. But but I think when people do powerful spiritual things together with you know, the right intention, what Muslims would call niyat, really beautiful repercussions happen, and we don't know all of those. And I think that's another part of Ramadan is the recognition that, you know, I don't control everything. There are things that I don't control, and I'm going to spend a month of the year in a physical practice of that, saying, I am giving up to God for these 14 hours a day.
And the two of you are showing all of us that maybe the future of interreligious work is about not just acquiring a mutual respect, but going through a shared experience that's sacred. My guests today are Eboo Patel and Brian McLaren. Eboo is founder of the Interfaith Youth Corps. You can read his writings in Washington Post's On Faith section. And Brian McLaren, as you just heard, has written several wonderful books that you may want to look at. He is a Christian writer. He's an activist. Check out his writing, including blog posts about his Ramadan fast at brianmclaren.net. We'll have links to both sites on our website, stateofbelief.com. Brian, Eboo, thanks to both of you for being with us on State of Belief.
Thanks, Welton. Thanks, great to talk with you again, Brian.
My producer wants me to ask you how the fast is going.
I'll just tell you that the first couple of days when I realized that, you know, a billion people around the world are doing this, I thought, boy, there are a lot of strong people out there. Because the food is tough, but the water is really tough. And I'm filled with a lot of admiration for all the people who do this year after year.
Eboo, how for you?
It's a beautiful challenge, but it's definitely a challenge.
I'm Welton Gaddy. We've got to take a short break, but we're going to, up next, take a look at the experience of Muslim and Arab Americans in the immediate aftermath of September 11th. The author of a book entitled Homeland Insecurity is our guest. After this break, we'll be right back.
State of Belief, once a week, not enough? Check out our website, stateofbelief.com.
Again, everybody, I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief. And recently, President Barack Obama hosted an iftar at the White House. An iftar is the evening meal that Muslims use to break the day-long fast during Ramadan. The audience at this particular iftar was made up of congresspeople and faith leaders, even one college-age Muslim basketball star. Here is President Obama addressing his guests.
Tonight, we celebrate a great religion and its commitment to justice and progress. We honor the contributions of America's Muslims and the positive example that so many of them set through their own lives, and we rededicate ourselves to the work of building a better and more hopeful world.
Many in the interfaith and Muslim communities have praised President Obama for his outreach to the Muslim world and his efforts to repair relations with Muslim Americans here at home. The president has repeatedly acknowledged that Islam is not the enemy. But in the years following September 11, 2001, many Muslims were led to believe the opposite. A mix of overreaching anti-terrorism laws and anti-Islam sentiment in the press, even hate crimes and vandalism, marginalized and victimized Muslim Americans. According to a new book, many in this community reported they feared for their own safety. The book is called Homeland Insecurity, The Arab American and Muslim American Experience After 9/11, published by the Russell Sage Foundation, and the author, Louise Kanekar, interviewed more than 100 Muslim Americans in the Chicago area from 2003 to 2004, and she paints a picture of what life was like for this religious minority following the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. Professor Kanekar recently spoke with my producer, Julie Mayshak. Take a listen, please, to that conversation.
Louise, thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Now, your research and interviews with Muslim Americans covered the years between 2003 and 2004. Give us a general picture. What kind of common themes did you discover, common sentiments among Muslim Americans at that time?
Well, they gave way to the title of the book, which is Homeland Insecurity. What I found, I mean, more than anything else, was this, you might call it a social psychological state of fear, of vulnerability, of insecurity, a sense that they did not feel safe and comfortable in the United States. It was a widespread feeling among members of the community that they might be placed in internment camps. So there was a sense that life just wasn't the same anymore, and it was very precarious and unsafe. And this came from both government policies and government statements and from actions on the part of members of the public.
Give us one or two examples, if you could. I'm particularly interested in the government statements that you're referring to.
Well, particularly Attorney General Ashcroft repeatedly made statements about us and them. You know, they are hiding in our communities waiting to attack us. We need to watch out for them. So these statements kind of set up this parameter that there was us, the Americans, mm-hmm. and there was them, the Arab and Muslims who live in this country, and kind of set them up as a population to be feared, a population that threatened our, you know, safety and security. And you know, then the byproduct of that was that people were shouting at Arab and Muslim Americans to go home, even, of course, if they were mm-hmm. born here or were third generation, go home, you don't belong here. So there was a lot of harassment on that level. So it was kind of like setting up a population as you're not part of our country. You mm-hmm. cannot be part of our country.
And as you point out in the book, a part of that existed pre-9/11 as well, that this was something that already existed in American culture. Talk a little bit about what you see the impressions of Muslim Americans pre-9/11 and how that contributed to this atmosphere.
Well, I argue and I give a long history showing, I think, defending the argument that holding Muslims and Arabs collectively responsible for the actions of 19 people would not and could not have happened if not already these stereotypes were in wide existence in the United States. So, I mean, if you compare it, for example, to the Oklahoma City bombing, mm-hmm. you know, one person, you know, was finally held accountable for that, but you didn't see this launching of government policies and these hate crimes, for example, perpetrated against all people of that perpetrator's ethnic background mm-hmm. or religious faith, right? I mean, he was seen as an individual.
Yeah.
But Arab and Muslim Americans have been portrayed as a group, as one group of people who all share the same values, and those values are, you know, they love violence, they don't like democracy, they hate our culture.
They're inherently un-American. I would say they're inherently un-American,
right,
is the stereotype.
Right. And these slogans have been really bandied about for, you know, 20 years prior to the 9/11 attacks. They are themes of movies, of books, of cartoons, mm-hmm, of Halloween masks. I mean, you name it, they were pervasive in our culture. So no surprise that when the attacks happened, that, you know, everybody from this religious faith or this, you know, certain ethnic backgrounds was held accountable as if they had the same points of view as those people.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the big picture, the American public as a whole is, for better or worse, knows more about Islam as
right.
a religion now.
Right.
And I'm curious how you see that affecting what you said earlier is, you know, the Muslim Americans, Islam, it was always something foreign. It was seen as something fundamentally un-American. Have we moved away from that, the better educated the American public now is about Islam and Muslim Americans?
I think that we are definitely moving away. I think that from this idea that it's some other religion, I
mm-hmm.
think that you know, if you look at the courses at universities
mm-hmm.
and public environments and books, and I think you can see kind of an explosion of good resources
yeah.
About Islam. And, you know, this is what happened to the Catholics and the Jews and,
mm-hmm.
the, you know, the Mormons and, you know, other religious groups different from the early mainstream core have faced this kind of attack. And now it's the time for the Muslims, and it looks like we're working through it as a society. At the same time, the voices who seek to exclude Muslims from American life are still out there
mm-hmm.
clamoring, and as I mentioned, the 2008 presidential campaign is great evidence of that, and you had Colin Powell's great statement,
mm-hmm.
Barack Obama is not a Muslim, but what if he was?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, Muslims have the right to dream of being president of the United States. So, you know, you do have these positive statements and positive movements forward. So I think we're moving along.
Louise Kainkar is a professor of sociology and social justice at Marquette University. She is the author of Homeland Insecurity, The Arab American and Muslim American Experience After 9/11. Louise, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Well, friends, that's our show for this week. Do you want to get in touch? Well, then write to us. Go to stateofbelief.com, click the Contact Us page, or you can call us. Remember, we've got a phone number, 202-238-3291. That's 202-238-3291. Tell us what you're thinking. We want to know. And talk about the show or anything else that's on your mind. State of Belief is brought to you each week by Interfaith Alliance. You want to get more involved in the cause for religious liberty? Then join us, please. Become a member. Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. And we'll be right back here on State of Belief next week with more stories from the intersection of religion and politics. And until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.